This ceremony was officiated by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at cmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Good morning, everyone. And a particular welcome to you, those of you who are coming as friends and family of those who are receiving the precepts this morning. And to those of you who are wherever you are, good morning to those of you at the temple and family and friends who are joining us today from your own place. So this morning, there are a group of students who are receiving Jikai. Kai means precepts, the teachings of the moral, ethical life of a Buddha, of a practicing Buddhist. The Buddha, in his original teachings, established what we call the three trainings: calming the mind through meditation, cultivating wisdom, insight, by seeing the nature of things as they are, and bringing forth great compassion. And so wisdom and compassion are seen as the two essential aspects of our humanity, of Buddhist practice, of our commitment as practitioners, particularly within our tradition of the Bodhisattva path. The Buddha realized that because as human beings we make choices, that those choices can either bring harm and injury and seeds of distrust into the world. And of course, we see more than ample examples of that. But we can also bring generosity and patience and loving kindness and compassion to this world. And the Buddha realized that as human beings, we're fundamentally moral beings, that we strive towards, we have an impulse, a natural impulse towards that which is life-affirming, and an impulse to move away from that which is destructive of life. And so as human beings, Buddhism really regards human life as a very profound gift if we use it well. And so with that gift is a responsibility to live our lives well. And that means we have to really consider and reflect and examine and make good choices. And because of our propensity, because of the history of humanity to be in conflict and wage different forms and systems of oppression and violence and so on, we see that we have to exert a particular kind of effort to actually live well. It doesn't just seem to naturally happen, unfortunately, although it is a natural aspect of our being. And so Buddhist practice is all about that. I recently read a passage from a book where the Dalai Lama was speaking, and he said, we are now living in an age in which, from a spiritual point of view, conditions have deteriorated. People are very intelligent and inventive, but the quality they often lack is true human goodness. Their intelligence is used more and more in destructive ways. So we have this brilliance within our mind, tremendous capacity. And yet, unfortunately, we can too easily use it in ways that are destructive. And so today, in Buddhism, it's considered a very profound thing because it means there's an internal alignment that these students have brought about within themselves and are now declaring in a very public way in front of all of you, their sangha, the people they care about, the people they practice with, the people they live with and love, that this is the basis upon which they want to live their lives, which includes all of you, all of us, and more. And so in taking a vow, that's a very solemn occasion because it's a thing of great significance, and it has great implications. And the nature of the vow is to hold ourselves accountable to it. Otherwise, why should we take vows? And in a certain sense, to be held accountable by those around us. And when we freely do that, that's a good thing. That's a necessary thing. And so it is also an occasion of joy and celebration. Okay. So to begin, the students will do three sets of bows. And the first set of bows will be to the Buddha, which is recognizing their spiritual lineage. And in this, we can also acknowledge, because those are our spiritual ancestors, their spiritual ancestors, we can also acknowledge our land ancestors, the Mohican Munsi people of this area, this land, this mountain that we now occupy. You're doing three bows to the Buddha. And so these bows are a way of acknowledging our a debt of gratitude and how we've arrived here, how you have arrived here. That the sense of a separate self, delusion as Buddhism understands it, is the idea that we stand autonomously and independently of other things, in a sense that we have come to this place on our own, which is, from a Buddhist perspective, a great delusion. And so in these bows, we acknowledge all of these different streams of interdependence. And so the second series of bows will be to their parents. And their parents are not here, so they will bow in the direction. You go into the Buddha home, and they'll bow in the direction of their parents. And if their parents are deceased, then they will bow in the directions in which they have been buried. And this, of course, is a way to acknowledge their blood lineage, those who gave them life in this life, and the debt of gratitude to them. Buddhism is a very contemplative practice, but in that inward turning, we realize how deeply, deeply bound we are to others and to all things. And in that recognition that becomes very non-intellectual, very vivid, very a direct knowing, there's a sense of responsibility, a sense of gratitude for what we have received, and a sense of responsibility to return, to give back. And in a sense, the more we see, the greater that debt becomes. We normally think of a debt as a bad thing, but in this case, it is a wonderful thing, right? And ultimately, we realize we'll never fully be able to repay that debt, which means we can then joyfully spend all of our lives trying. These students have all been practicing for a number of years as training students, and that's so that they can really experience what it is to be a practitioner and know that this is their path and really sort of settle into that and establish that in their lives, so that then that becomes the basis from which they can then today take these vows with their eyes wide open. And this set of vows is to the Kaishi, the precept teacher, who today is myself. So we'll begin with the invocation of the three treasures, the three treasures of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, which for Buddhists really, in a sense, constitutes both our spiritual world. The Buddha is our original teacher, but Buddha means awakened one, and the Buddha realized all of us have that enlightened nature present within us from birth. It's nothing that we can create. It's nothing that we could ever lose. But all beings have that, and so the Buddha treasure is the, in a sense, the original Buddha, all enlightened beings and all beings at large, because they all possess Buddha nature. Dharma is the teachings of the Buddha, the teachings of all enlightened beings. an all phenomenal reality, because all phenomena in itself is true. And the Sangha, which is the practitioners of Buddha Dharma, so it's our Sangha, but it's also all Buddha Sanghas, but it's really all beings, because all people from a Buddhist perspective are within the Buddhist nature of things. So we'll do an invocation to bring Buddha Dharma and Sangha fully alive here in this hall this morning. So if everyone please gassho, you're choking. Being one with the Buddha in the 10 directions, being one with the Dharma in the 10 directions, be one with the Sangha in the 10 directions, be one with our original teacher, Shakyamuni Buddha, be one with the great compassionate Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, be one with the great wise Samantabhadra Bodhisattva, be one with the great wise Manjushri Bodhisattva, be one with Kosojo Yodaishi, be one with Taisojo Saidaishi, be one with the successive great ancestors, be one with the Buddha in the 10 directions, be one with the Dharma in the 10 directions, be one with the Sangha in the 10 directions, be one with our original teacher, Shakyamuni Buddha, be one with the great compassionate Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, be one with the great wise Samantabhadra Bodhisattva, be one with the great wise Manjushri Bodhisattva, be one with Kosojo Yodaishi, be one with Taisojo Saidaishi, be one with the successive great ancestors, be one with the Buddha in the 10 directions, be one with the Dharma in the 10 directions, be one with the Sangha in the 10 directions, be one with our original teacher, Shakyamuni Buddha, be one with the great compassionate Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, be one with the great wise Samantabhadra Bodhisattva, be one with the great wise Manjushri Bodhisattva, be one with Kosojo Yodaishi, be one with Taisojo Saidaishi, be one with the successive great ancestors. Kosojoyo and Taisojo Sayers, Dogen and Keizan, respectively. And as you notice, very often we are doing something of importance. It's repeated three times as a way of really bringing it in very deeply. Next is the Gatha of Atonement. And we have spent a lot of time talking and discussing this and learning about this, practicing this. So in establishing this path, the Buddha realized, and morality being an essential part of it, because we're trying to cease from harm, creating harm in our lives, to really be all about practicing good and bringing benefit into the world, that in order to do that, we have to face the things we've done in our lives that were not good, that were not helpful, and the karmic weight of that we carry, because that can lead us to cause more harm. It also means we have to face the harm that has been done to us by others that we may carry the weight of, so that we can proceed step by step more freely, lightly, clearly. And so the Gatha of Atonement is a very important practice where we acknowledge that hurtful karma we describe as evil karma that includes everything. And from a traditional Buddhist perspective, this is not just in this lifetime, but it's in all of our past lifetimes, if you believe in rebirth. It also includes everything we might have ever done that's harmful that we don't even know about, right? Not everything registers in our consciousness. We don't always notice when we do something that has been hurtful. And that we acknowledge, we recognize that this is, that the hurtful karma that we've created has been born out of our tendency towards greediness, towards anger, towards pride and jealousy, towards our delusions, our false views, and that those actions that have been hurtful come through our thoughts, our speech, and our physical actions. And acknowledging all that, then we atone for it, which means to take full responsibility and actually to dissolve the separation between ourselves, which is the space in which we tend to fall into blame, making excuses, rationalizing, and so on. And so part of the Bodhisattva path is to be fearless in terms of taking responsibility for the things that belong to us and knowing that that is the only path towards peace of mind, towards joyfulness, towards being a benefit to others. So we'll all do that together. Everyone is invited to to join in, we'll do it as a call and response, a call and echo. Okay, everybody please kind of show. Holy Vokarm ever committed by me since of old. On account of my beginningless greed, anger, and ignorance. Born of my body, mouth, and thought. Now I atone for it all. All evil karma ever committed by me since of old. On account of my beginningless greed, anger, and ignorance.
On account of my beginningless greed, anger, and ignorance.
Born of my body, mouth, and thought.
Born of my body, mouth, and
thought. Now I atone for it all.
Now I atone for it all.
All evil karma ever committed by me since of old. On account of my beginningless greed, anger, and ignorance.
On account of my beginningless greed, anger, and ignorance.
Born of my body, mouth, and thought.
Born of my body, mouth, and thought.
Now I atone for it all.
Now I atone for it all.
Okay. Remember to give me your eyes. Next is what we call shasui, which is a spurging with clear mountain spring water from the bowels of this beautiful mountain with this pine bough. And it's not a purification because the Buddha realized all of us fundamentally are without any impurity, but rather it's an expression of the Buddha mind, which exists within each of us, which is within each of you in full. And in training undergoes a long process of transmission, even though it's never been apart. Water has also, all the way through the ages, been associated in almost every spiritual tradition as an essential element. It's just one bow. And now we'll take refuge in the three treasures. So having invoked the three treasures, we take refuge. And this is one of the oldest teachings, practices in Buddhism. Originally the Buddha, as I understand it, ordained his students with the three treasures. So taking refuge, as Master Dogen speaks of it, is to unreservedly rely upon. You know, one of the difficult things to do in this life, because all of us have been hurt, is to trust, to have faith. And we see what happens when that is lacking, how difficult it is to live, to be in relationship, to move forward, to take chances, to have courage. We see what happens when as a nation or as a country, faith is systematically injured. And so it's a tremendously important aspect of practice, of life. And so to have that level of faith in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha is it really what allows you to practice. It allows you to have come this far. It will be there at every step along the way, and it will be equal to what all that you do in the Dharma, right? It is the door that opens and is the passageway. And so taking refuge is an expression of that deep faith, which is not a blind faith. In Buddhism, we practice based on faith because we don't know yet. And then through your practice, your actual lived experience, you verify that faith. It becomes your own body and mind. So in that sense, it's no longer faith. Now it's your experience. But that emboldens you to have more faith. And on it goes. So we'll take refuge in three treasures. I'll do this three times. The second time will be call and response. And everyone is invited to take refuge together. Okay, Choki, everyone please go show. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha. I take refuge in the Buddha, the incomparably honored one. I take refuge in the Dharma, honorable for its purity. I take refuge in the Sangha, honorable for its harmony. I have taken refuge in the Buddha. I have taken refuge in the Dharma. I have taken refuge in the Sangha. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha. I take refuge in the Buddha, the incomparably honored one. I take refuge in the Buddha, the incomparably honored one. I take refuge in the Dharma, honorable for its purity. I take refuge in the Sangha, honorable for its harmony. I have taken refuge in the Buddha. I have taken refuge in the Dharma. I have taken refuge in the Sangha. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha. I take refuge in the Buddha, the incomparably honored one. I take refuge in the Dharma, honorable for its purity. I take refuge in the Sangha, honorable for its harmony. I have taken refuge in the Buddha. I have taken refuge in the Dharma. I have taken refuge in the Sangha. Will you maintain this? Jessica, can you move your seat just a little bit to your right so I can see Joanne there? There. Okay. Next is the three pure precepts. So the pure precepts are, in a sense, the simplest, broadest, most straightforward way of presenting how an enlightened being both sees the world and lives in the world. The first pure precept is to not create evil. And this establishes that evil, all harmful actions, only occur within the human mind and human action. Evil does not just exist in the world as a force outside of human beings. It is solidly within the realm of human beings. That's what we are singularly concerned about as practitioners, right? That is our responsibility. And so to not create evil is to recognize all the ways in which we create harm. And evil is a very strong word, right? And it's really, its intention is to just encompass the whole range of all the different ways in which we can inflict harm, from the minor things to the most egregious actions. To not create evil. This is the abiding place of all Buddhas. This is the very source of all Buddhas. Do not create evil. Will you maintain this?
I vow to not create evil.
So Buddhism is a very profound and mystic path. And because of that, it's also very grounded and practical. So on the path of liberating ourselves from suffering, first we have to stop creating suffering. Okay. The second pure precept then necessarily follows that having dedicated ourselves to not creating harm or not creating evil, now we need to put energy into practicing good. And so again, good in the same way, all that is beneficial that we can bring forth from our body, from our words and our thoughts, has to be brought forth. It doesn't just exist in the world. And so to practice good is to make this very real, very alive. In a way, it's just a way of being in the world. To practice good, this is the Dharma of Samyak Sambodhi, the perfect, unexcelled enlightenment. This is the way of all beings. Practice good. Will you maintain this? Practice good reaches everywhere. It doesn't designate any object, any time, any witness. The third pure precept is to actualize good for others. So here it ensures that the lives that we're living, the things that we're doing, actually has positive influences on human beings and all living things. This is to transcend the profane and to be beyond the holy, to liberate oneself and others, to actualize good for others. Will you maintain this?
I vow to actualize good for others.
Now, because the precepts, like all moral teachings, are presented in terms of what not to do and what to do, they can very easily in our mind be reduced to just a list of rules, another set of rules. And in that way, they can become very lifeless. They can be very external, right? Somebody is telling me I am supposed to be, which is not really what our practice is about, right? And so what's really important to appreciate is these are living teachings, living vows. It's not dogmatic. They're not fixed. And so we've talked about the different perspectives that these precepts are to be understood very directly, just as they sound, as they are expressed. But sometimes to just adhere to that as a fixed rule will actually cause harm rather than alleviate it. And so there's a perspective of out of reverence and compassion for life. Sometimes we have to seemingly violate that precept in order to actually bring forth compassion. There's a third perspective of the Bodhidharma One Mind precept, which is really based in the reality of emptiness. How does all things arising from emptiness inform you as practitioners? Dasani Roshi talked about time, place, position, degree, that the conditions in which an action is taking place influence the person taking that action, influence how that action is experienced. These are not fixed things. They're alive. They're dynamic. Those are also the conditions that we can work with that can change an action, change the consequence of an action. We talked about how in atonement, in asking forgiveness, in giving forgiveness, we're changing the conditions in which the consequences of an action are flowing forth to ameliorate or diminish, mitigate the harm of that action. Very profound. So the grave precepts that follow the pure precepts are helping us to understand what are those things that in human existence, as long as we've been human beings, whenever we are in relationship to anything, particularly other people, what are the things that we historically do that cause the most harmful karmic consequences, right? Out of all of the range of the things that we can do, right? What are those things that have been seen over and over and over again, not just in Buddhism, but in other traditions that create the most harm, either because of the magnitude of the action or because of the repetitiveness of the action? And so these grave precepts are very profound in bringing our attention to those things that we need to bring our attention to. Okay? So the first of the grave precepts is to affirm life, to not kill. Buddhism is based in non-harming. All life is life. To love life is our natural inclination. Every life wants to live. And so our responsibility is not to take that life away. Every creature exists within its own intricate web of causes and conditions. The basic nature of all things is non-harming, and yet we must take life to live. That is also true of all life. Every creature is complete unto itself. And that's why we practice so much cultivating respect and reverence, understanding the sacredness of things. Each thing has its own virtue, its own place, its own responsibility, in a sense, to fulfill its place. So to not steal that away. Life, Dogen said, is non-killing. The seed of Buddha grows continuously. Maintain the wisdom life of Buddha and do not kill life. Vow to affirm life. Do not kill. Will you maintain this?
I vow to affirm life. I will not kill.
This is why in our training, when we take meals, we do have services before the meal. When we do formal meals, we do them in a very sort of profound religious practice sense, where we're really clear that we are, in taking this life, we have a responsibility to give life back. The next precept is to be giving, to not steal. Giving is life. Life is giving. Without giving, we create a kind of isolation that we become bound to. We become caught within a self-created sense of separateness. In giving, in the act of giving, the first paramita, our mutual and essential codependence becomes not only clear to us, but becomes manifest. We become larger. To give means we have to let go of our clinging. It means we have to realize we are not isolated in this world. There's others that we can be generous with. It is very profoundly transformative. And so this precept is about really practicing a non-grasping mind. To not seek contentment in taking things, power, status, positions, objects that do not belong to us, but rather be cultivating generosity. To not believe in the illusion of your own insufficiency and then to go seeking something outside. Dogen said, the mind and externals are just thus. The gate of liberation is always open. Vow to be giving, do not steal. Will you maintain this?
I vow to be giving, I will not steal.
Cultivating, realizing selflessness is the sort of becoming large, becoming magnanimous, opening up that natural generosity that we all have. The third great precept is to honor the whole person, to not misuse sexuality. Desire is an incredibly powerful force. It is, in a sense, the most powerful force in the human world. It's present within all the suffering of the world, based in self-clinging, it creates all of our pain and sorrow. But when we free that desire of self-clinging, it becomes generosity. It becomes concern for others. And so desire is also in the heart of bodhicitta, the aspiration for enlightenment. It's in the, your desire to practice these precepts and your intention to do so. And so it's all, what is the basis of that desire and how do we use it? Sexual desire is a very particular form of desire. It's in every living thing, not just human beings. And it is life itself. It's necessary in a sense, but it can also destroy. It can destroy love. It can destroy trust. It can destroy the bonds that we depend upon between us. It can create very deep wounds. But sexual desire can also heal wounds. It can bring us together. It can instill trust. It can breed and it bring forth intimacy, bring us closer. And so this precept is really based in the understanding, the practice that no person is an idea or projection or an object. They are not to be owned or possessed or used. To honor the whole person, to not misuse sexuality, Dogen says the three wheels, body, mouth, and mind, greed, anger, delusion, are pure and clean. In essence, nothing is desired. Go the same way as the Buddha. Vow to honor the whole person. Do not misuse sexuality. Will you maintain this?
I vow to honor the whole person. I will not misuse sexuality.
The fourth precept is to manifest truth. To not lie, which is considered a very important precept because our whole practice is about realizing the nature of what is true. When we open the Dharma eye, we see that all things are true in and of themselves. Nothing exists in a state of deception. Falseness only exists in the mind. The Buddha way is the path of seeing clearly, seeing through all falseness. Bodhidharma said, when we don't understand, everything that is true seems false. When we do understand, everything that appeared false now is seen as true. So this vow is really to cultivate the courage to be unafraid of what is true. Rather than turn away from what is real, to actually seek what is real and to manifest it through our thoughts, our words, and our actions. To live without deception. Deception is really to live without regret, which, as Milarepa said, is the great reward, to live lightly, straightforwardly. The Dharma wheel unceasingly turns, and there is neither excess nor incompleteness. Sweet dew permeates the universe. Gain the essence and realize the truth. Vow to maintain, to manifest truth, to not lie. Will you maintain this?
Vow to manifest truth, to not lie.
And this precept is a good example of how if we just follow it as a rule and always speak what we perceive to see the truth, that sometimes we may cause harm unnecessarily. And so sometimes in order to manifest compassion, we may have to speak in a way that appears false, but is actually being done for the benefit of others. And of course, that means we have to be very clear within ourselves that that's what's actually happening. The next precept is to proceed clearly, to not cloud the mind. This is based in the fact that your mind is the original clear Buddha mind. And so to cloud the mind through intoxicants, through drugs, or just through obsessive anything that really dims, dulls the brightness, the clarity of your own natural mind, moves us further away from ourselves and in a sense makes us very vulnerable to actions that will be harmful, right? And it also distances us from the vibrancy that is present in all things, in our life itself. When we encounter more and more practice through meditation, encounter the true self, we no longer, less and less do we want to seek the escape that we tend to use through clouding the mind. When we encounter that bright, clear mind, we no longer want to dwell in fogginess. That's no longer interesting. Ultimately, of course, we see there is no escape. There is no turning away. That itself is an illusion. Everywhere you go, you find yourself. For a practitioner, that's actually good news. To become numb only increases the pain. The mind is the originally pure and clear Buddha mind. Do not let it become cloudy. Do not be defiled. Vow to proceed clearly. Do not cloud the mind. Will you maintain this?
I vow to proceed clearly. I will not cloud the mind.
And because ours is a middle path, trying to avoid attaching to extremes, this means that as practitioners, when with friends, with family, to bring one closer to each other when one has a drink, right? To be clear in the mind about what you're doing, right? And to be, see the difference, see when it changes towards becoming something else, right? So in that way, it is not cloudy in the mind. The next precept is to see the perfection, to not speak of others' errors and faults. Dada Roshi said that mistakes we are called learning. That it is in our mistakes and the mistakes of others that we both encounter our humanity, that we free ourselves from the tyranny of the illusion of perfection, which is just an idea, and that we begin to understand how to be fully human and awake. And so when we speak of others' errors and faults, we're focusing on something in a way that's very unclear. And we're usually doing that to create a sense of otherness, estranging ourselves, differencing ourselves from another, elevating ourselves, which is what the next precept speaks to. And that sense of otherness is present in every form of violence, of hatred, of oppression, of injury. Even to the people we love the most, in the moment when we hurt them, we have turned them into a stranger in our mind. To be free of right and wrong within this world of right and wrong is to go beyond all of the comparisons and the judgments and see through those illusions. So that when we need to speak of others' errors and faults, we're only doing that for someone's benefit, to help. In the midst of the Buddha Dharma, we're the same way, the same Dharma, the same realization, the same practice. Do not speak of others' errors and faults. Do not destroy the way. Vow to see the perfection. Do not speak of others' errors and faults. Will you maintain this?
Vow to see the perfection. I will not speak of others' errors and faults.
These precepts on deception, on speaking of others' errors and faults, and this present one that we're going to now, are all within the realm of right speech. The Buddha realized the incredible power of our language to both cause pain and suffering as well as to help liberate ourselves. To realize self and others as one, do not elevate the self and blame others. So this is another way that we can use speech, is to put someone down and pick ourselves up. Usually at a moment when we are feeling not so good about the self that we possess or that we seem to possess. The sense of self is a self-creation of the self-clinging mind. In every moment, there is only this single moment of birth and death. There is no one to build up, no one to bring down, no person to defend, no person ultimately to criticize. For the sake of compassion, sometimes we need to speak of others. We need to see differences. We need to recognize in certain ways high and low, but recognize the construction of those. And that the only use for those is if they are useful, if they're actually helping to affirm life. When there's no self-clinging, we're no longer carried along by praise or pushed down by blame. We realize each person is complete, fulfilling their own virtue. And as practitioners, we begin to understand more and more their karmic path. Buddhas and ancestors realize the absolute emptiness in the whole earth. When the great body is manifested, there is no outside or inside. When the Dharma body is manifested, there's not a square inch of earth upon which to stand. Vow to realize self and others as one, to not elevate the self and blame others. Will you maintain this?
I vow to realize self and others as one. I will not elevate the self.
Blame others. This means that even when we're in very adverse circumstances, or we're at the in a situation of being marginalized or targeted, for instance, as a historically excluded person of color or identity, that even in that moment, recognizing the profound difficulty of those conditions, that what Buddhism is asking us to do is to really take responsibility for whatever actions we bring forth in that moment. The next precept is to give generously, to not be withholding. This precept is speaking to stinginess, to all the ways in which we have something to offer, but we hold it back, we hesitate, we're selfish. Again, the Buddha way is a path of generosity and magnanimity, to have an open, spacious heart. That we always have something to offer. And Buddhism acknowledges in so many different teachings and stories how even the simplest things, when given with a sincere heart, have great power. To be withholding creates an inner sense of confinement and anxiety. When we give generously, it frees us from this story of not enough. We see that it's better to live simply and deeply than to be burdened with what we treasure too much. Now we can enjoy what we have without fear of loss. One phrase, one verse, 10,000 forms, 100 grasses, one Dharma, one realization, all Buddhas, all ancestors, the whole world. Since the beginning, there never has been anything to withhold. Vow to give generously, do not be withholding. Will you maintain this?
I vow to give generously, I will not be withholding.
In training, we're given many, many opportunities all throughout the day to practice this. For instance, in a bow. The next precept, the ninth precept, is to actualize harmony, to not be angry. Anger is one of the great forces. Greed is also one of the great forces in our lives that can really cause a lot of trouble. It only arises within us when the past seeds of anger are already present. It is not something that someone can give to us, cause in us, in an absolute sense. They can be part of the conditions under which we become angry, but the anger is ours. It's like a burning fire. It can bring a house down. It can burn down a whole town. But if used without self-clinging, it can be like thunder that wakes you up from a deep sleep, that calls someone to an urgent matter. It comes down to whether they're self-clinging. Who is it for? Right? Who is it serving? To live within a state of anger is like a slow-burning illness. And so the bodhisattva is really deciding to do whatever they can to practice skillfully, to acknowledge whatever anger we have, because we all experience it, in an honest and straightforward way, so that ultimately we can free ourselves of it. And that's most important, so that we don't just suppress or try and deny the anger, but rather work through it skillfully so that we can be free of it. It also means that within anger, that we need to be willing to make the first move. Right? That sometimes it's more important to be free than to be right. This precept is wonderful in calling us to it in the moment of anger. We might think that we have to wait until we're not angry anymore to practice this precept, but that's not true. It's when we are angry that this precept becomes most important. And in that, when you're practicing that anger, that's compassion. It may not feel like it because you're angry, but when you take responsibility for that anger and actually are making choices in accord with your vows, that is what compassion looks like in that moment. It is not regressing, it is not advancing, it's not real, it's not unreal. There is an illuminated cloud ocean, there's an ornamented cloud ocean. Vow to actualize harmony, do not be angry. Will you maintain this?
I vow to actualize harmony, I will not be angry.
And for all of us who are in this ongoing study in karma, we just discussed the two truths this week. See that in Dogen's teachings. It is not real, it is not unreal. And then the final great precept is to experience the intimacy of things, to not defile the three treasures, having begun by taking refuge, realizing the Sangha treasure as your community, but most profoundly as your body and mind, to not defile the three treasures. The three treasures are what transforms these teachings into Buddha Dharma, into the Eightfold Path, into the mind of Nirvana. When we turn against the three treasures, we turn against our own home. We turn against our own body and mind, our own natural mind. So to take refuge in and practice taking refuge and protecting that is important. When we are struggling and we direct that towards the Buddha, might be your teacher, towards the Dharma, might be your practice or the teachings, towards the Sangha, and this happens in training, to recognize that and to practice this precept and to deal with that struggle from within your commitment to Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. That's a very profound thing. When we put ourselves outside, that's a very different matter. To address a difficulty or have a criticism from within that bondage of love is very powerful. Living the Dharma with the whole body and mind is the heart of wisdom and compassion. All virtues return to the ocean of reality. You should not comment on them, just practice them, realize them, and actualize them. Vow to experience the intimacy of things, do not defile the three treasures. Will you maintain this? And Choki? These 16 precepts, the three treasures, the three pure precepts, and the 10 gray precepts, have been handed down by Shakyamuni Buddha generation after generation to my teacher, to myself, and now I hand them to you. Will you maintain them well? Will you maintain them well? Will you really maintain them well? Okay, three bows. You know, what's important for everybody to appreciate is that as practitioners and in taking these vows, that we realize that these vows that we're taking, these precepts that we're promising to live by, we will transgress. We will. We will violate them. We will not always live in accord with these. That's why it's important to take the vows and to hold ourselves and each other accountable in a loving way, with compassion, right? Because that is our humanity. And in that way, there's space in which to be a practitioner of the Dharma, to aim high, as Dogen said, but also to stand on your ground where you are. And so when that ground is cloudy, when that ground is unstable, when your mind is unclear, and you act out of that, you have these vows to practice. That's why they're important. Sometimes we put unrealistic projections on practitioners who have received the precepts and think that they should somehow now be faultless, right? Which is a falseness. That's right, it's not true. And at the same time, these precepts mean something, right? You are committing to these. Otherwise, you know, we're wasting our time and our life is too short to waste our time. Yes? Yes. Okay. So. And within not wasting of time in the great urgency, there's plenty of time for rest and relaxation. the Buddha's robe. Lean forward a little bit. Okay. The blood lineage of the ancestors. Zen Mountain Monastery in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This is to certify that Jessica Ludwig, having fulfilled the precepts, training requirements of the Mountains and Rivers Order, has on the 17th day of October, 2021, received the 16 precepts of the Buddha Way, the lineage chart, the Raksu, and has been given the Dharma name Shoke. So the Raksu, the students all week have been sewing the Raksu, which is a robe, a religious robe, that is part of our lineage, our tradition, and that they actually stitched the three treasures with every stitch into the robe, and so it's all a creation of your own hands and mind. And on the back is calligraphied your name, and I'll talk about that in a moment. And this robe is a sort of a living expression of your vows. And so when you practice with it, you're infusing it with your vows. It also sort of is a sort of a sign of having taken these vows. So in that way, it also serves as a reminder. Lean forward. The Buddha's robe. The list of ancestors. The lineage of ancestors. Joanne Dierkop, having fulfilled the requirements of the Mountains and Rivers Order, has on the 17th day of October, 2021, received the 16 precepts of the Bodhisattva path, the lineage chart, the Raksu, and has been given the Dharma name Jishin. Jimmy, can you push that forward a little bit and get a little bit closer so it's easier to reach you? Okay. Come forward. The Buddha's robe. Kichimyaku. Jimmy Stone, having fulfilled the requirements, training requirements of the Mountains and Rivers Order, has on the 17th day of October, 2021, the 16 precepts of the Buddha Way, the lineage chart, the Raksu, and has been given the Dharma name Seikaku. List of the ancestors. Jack Hennessy, having fulfilled the precepts training requirements of the Mountains and Rivers Order, has on the 17th day of October 2021 received the 16 precepts of the Budawe, the lineage chart, the Raksu, and has been given the Dharma name Kanro. The lineage of ancestors. Diana Strablau, having fulfilled the precepts training requirements of this order, has on the 17th day of October 2021 received the 16 precepts of the Bodhisattva path, the lineage chart, the Raksu, and has been given the Dharma name Unsen. I should also add that the students are also given a separate list of the women's ancestors that we chant every day. Choki, will everyone please gassho? When sentient beings receive the sila, they enter the realm of the Buddhas, which is none other than the great enlightenment. Truly, they are the children of the Buddha. When sentient beings receive the sila, they enter the realm of the Buddhas, which is none other than the great enlightenment. Truly, they are the children of the Buddha. When sentient beings receive the sila, they enter the realm of the great enlightenment, which is none other than the great enlightenment. Truly, they are the children of the Buddha. Okay. Now, these new bodhisattvas will walk through the zendo, passing in front of everyone's seat. And this is an opportunity for the Sangha to acknowledge their having received these vows. And so as they pass you, please return their walking bow with a bow at your seat. This is a way of making real how we all do this together, right? That when somebody takes vows or enters into training or is ordained, that we are all part of that. And in that way, we all have a responsibility to each other. This is the real heart and mind of the Bodhisattva, recognizing that it's not just a matter of doing the right thing or not doing the wrong thing based on some external idea, but it's actually our fundamental nature. That's why when we cause harm, if we're in touch with ourselves, it's painful when we hurt someone. And those of you at home, I hope, have also bowed as they passed in front of you. We had another student, Malcolm, who might be here with us this morning, who was supposed to be or intended to be here, but he had some urgent family matters that he needed to attend to. So he rightfully stayed at home to take care of those, and we'll do Jukai at a later time. And that's a good example of how to really understand these precepts meant for him to delay his receiving them formally so that he could practice them. So now let me say a little bit about your names. So it's common in many religious traditions to receive a religious name, a spiritual name. In our tradition, because everything is directed towards the service, in service of your own liberation, practice and awakening, your names are very much that. So they have meanings. They're based in Chinese characters, because that's the Zen tradition came out of the transmission of Buddhism from India to China. Our direct lineage is from Japan, so we use a Japanese pronunciation. And so in that sense, we sort of carry those different aspects of our tradition. So Joanne Jishin, your name. Ji is the character for compassion, for having the boundless love of the Bodhisattva, the great heart of selfless loving kindness that arises from that very selflessness. So whenever an action is done out of, free of self-concern or looking for reward, but is really just out of the desire to serve another, that's Ji, the great compassion coming forth. It is the heart of Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, who hears the cries of those who are suffering and responds. Ji is never controlling or manipulative, which means to manifest compassion, we have to learn how to tolerate other people's suffering, how to be patient and forbearing with other people's suffering, knowing that we cannot take it away from them. But we can be instruments that in various skillful ways may help to alleviate it or diminish it. So in that way, G is never aggressive or harsh. Sometimes though, so it can be as soft as a gentle breeze, but sometimes it is as firm as a mountain. It burns like a hot fire, but always for the well-being of others. Shin is the character in this case for faith, trust, faith in your Buddha nature, in your perfect nature, faith in your ability and capacity to practice and to bring forth compassion, faith in your humanity, and also faith in others, in their humanity, their enlightened nature, their freedom to choose liberation and their freedom to choose suffering. And sometimes it's very difficult to recognize that we cannot force someone to not choose suffering. And then recognizing that to not give up on them. And so this is a deep faith that is not measured by success or failure, but comes from the unknowable depths of your own wisdom nature. So Jishin, compassionate faith. Jessica, your name, Shokei. Sho is the name for sacred, divine, holy. In a Buddhist sense, of course, that's not based in a belief in God, although if a person has a belief in God, that it may very much incorporate that. But it is recognizing from a Buddhist perspective that because all things are complete unto themselves, all things are true, they are already worthy of our respect and reverence. They are already, in that sense, sacred. As Wendell Berry said, there's nothing that is not sacred. There is only that which we desecrate through our actions. All things abide in their own Dharma state. In our mind, we may see things as lacking that wholeness or that sacredness, but that's just our false way of seeing things. So sacred, divine. K is the mani jewel, the gem, the pearl, the dragon at the front gate that each of you had to safely pass by to enter, is holding that jewel which is your own enlightened mind. And to obtain that, to realize that mind, you have to deal with that dragon. It is held in the claw of the dragon, which is an enlightened being, which means you have to enter the dragon's cave and face her, face to face. Meeting that dragon, you meet yourself. Obtaining that jewel, you realize your Buddha nature. Realizing your nature, you liberate all beings from suffering. Dogen said, the world in all 10 directions is just one bright jewel. Shokhei, sacred jewel. Jimmy, your name, Seikaku. Sei means vow. This most powerful force to bring forward that you are all engaged in today. You're all in the midst of Sei. A solemn pledge, an inner commitment that is made, which means that that should happen only after careful thought and reflection and examination. So that then, today, you can then leap madly into that vow. Why madly? Because you don't know what happens next, right? That's the deal. You make that commitment, you leap forward knowing that you do not know what your life is going to bring to you. You know that it will bring you challenges because life has adversity in it. You know that you will sometimes be knocked back a step. And that's why it is so important to leap into that vow so that you hold it close to you. So vow for us means to bind yourself in the best way, freely, knowingly, to remember what must not be forgotten. It is a rudder that keeps you on the path. It is a sail that the wind moves you forward. It is the boat that carries you across. Kaku means to awaken, to enlighten, to remember. Kaku is to illuminate what has been dark, to awaken from the dream, to remember what has been forgotten, to understand beyond knowing. And so Seikaku is the vow of awakening. It is the awakened vow. So it is a vow that is both made within that mind that is already awakened, and it is the vow to help you come to that awakening, Seikaku. Jack, your name is Kanro. Kan means barrier, that which obstructs, which hinders, from moving forward, which holds you back. In Buddhism, we speak of it as our greed, our pride, our jealousy, our fear, our self-doubt, our irritation, all of the things that cause harm internally, externally. It is seeing the world in terms of opposites, which leads us to have seen one side, we have to pick this side or that side. Are you with us or against us? Right? That path never leads us to peace. It never leads us to a state of ease and rest or compassion. Dukkha is not having what we want, not being with whom we want. It is a life of control and conflict. It is that experience that we all have of Khan. Ro means open, exposed, spacious, boundless. The great way is not difficult. Just avoid grasping and rejecting. When we attach to something, the barrier is born and becomes stronger. When we let go, the barrier seems to fall away. When we see the barrier is no longer outside, is no longer something that has its own existence, then the barrier is realized as a gate, a gateless gate. All along the way has been clear and unhindered. The self that binds is the self that liberates, is the self that is unborn and undying. There are not two. From the beginning, there never was an iron mountain that would not let you pass. So Kanro is the barrier exposed, open. And Diana, your name is Ansen. An is the An of Ango, peaceful, calm, relaxed, at ease. Then in ordinary life, even when we're relaxed, we're not fully at ease. On is that utter release, peaceful dwelling. It is the peace that you cannot create, that already abides freely within you. A constructed peace will always come apart. This is the peace that is already present within you and every creature. And to experience this on, we must be peace itself. To arrive here, we must practice that on, that peace, that calm, that at ease, to calm the troubled waters of the mind and heart. Sen means spring or water. And water, as I said before, is a very powerful element in Buddhism. Whatever the vessel you pour it into, it assumes that shape perfectly and always is true to itself. Water doesn't know how to be false. It is cool. It is fresh. It is life itself. It is the spring that arises from the heart, the depth of the earth. It's the water that we drink here on this mountain. And all creatures gravitate to this spring. We all drink from this spring. And so it is a life-giving source. And it is peace. Flowing down the mountainside, the spring continues its journey to the great ocean, merging with the many waters. Nothing can prevent its journey from taking place. So onsen, peaceful spring, peaceful waters. Look at what you've done. You have entered into a profound implication of living a life dedicated to awakening and to manifesting true compassion. From a Buddhist perspective, there is no greater way. There is no greater path. Whatever the tradition, it doesn't have to be a Buddhist path. For you, it is. Because ultimately, it is a human path. It is the human path. And these precepts, these teachings, have no fixed form. So important to understand. They are not rules. They are free of that kind of rigidity, and yet they're not ambiguous. They're not ambivalent. They're very clear. If they are not clear to us, that's all that means. It's not clear to me at this moment how to live this vow. So get clear. Become clear. You have a practice to help you do that. But know that they are always clear. The Buddha Dharma, as I've often said, knows much more about us than we tend to know about ourselves. It's good to meet such a thing. So these precepts have been given to you today. Now they belong to you to live, to practice, and in the presence of the Sangha and your family and friends, you've made these vows. And so now in that way, you become a living link in this tradition, going all the way back to the Buddha. Know that. And with these vows, your practice and your life has changed. In some ways that you already recognize, and in many ways that you will continue to see over the years to come, which is what makes them so exquisite. Is there never not alive? May they illuminate your life and the lives of all that you touch. May your life go well.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.